This is Flex and Herds bringing you Death of the Reader here on 2SER. It is our second week discussing The Sign of the Four by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the second novel in the Sherlock Holmes canon. We are discussing chapters 6 to 9 this week on the show, in which, Herds, Sherlock Holmes does everything I expected he would.
Yes.
In just about the order I expected he would.
Look, I'm not going to confirm or deny that this is the most straightforward murder mystery we've had on this show, but it is either going to be exactly what Sherlock Holmes says it is, or there's some crazy twist and he's just been fooling us the whole time.
Yeah, I do not think it is in the spirit of the old-fashioned British sensibilities of literature that we are currently stuck headfirst into to undermine Sherlock Holmes here. It seems more like we are actually going to get further and further in and have more characters explain what complicated things Sherlock managed to weasel his way around to make him look even better.
Well, I will say we get introduced to quite a few new characters. We get to see Sherlock Holmes' gang that he leads, the Baker Street Irregulars, who apparently he just has a bunch of like other amateur detectives that aren't as qualified as he is, but I guess more qualified than Watson, question mark, who he can just tell to like run around and spy on people.
Are these the young kids that he brings in and pays off to tell him everything he needs to know?
I'm pretty sure, yes. I'm pretty sure this is literally an army of orphans.
Impression I got as well.
I don't know that it's ever explicitly stated who they are or where they come from, but that's the impression I get, that they're just a bunch of orphans. And he's like, I'll pay you. Sure thing, kid. And yeah, that's it. That's the Baker Street Irregulars. We've also met a bumbling policeman, a rival detective who doesn't know really what he's doing, is following Sherlock Holmes around, and a dog. And that's honestly the best new character.
Toby is the best new character. I love the introduction scenes every time someone just happens to know Sherlock Holmes. It's like, oh, a confrontation. We have no idea what to do. And then someone mentions Sherlock Holmes and all problems are solved.
Yeah, exactly. Like it happened with the doorkeeper. Where he's like, I would like to come in and see my literal brother. And he's like, well, your brother didn't tell me you was coming, so you're going to have to wait out there while we figure it out. And Sherlock Holmes is like, hi, didn't we used to like fight out in the streets that one time? And he's like, oh yeah, you put up a really good fight, you do. Come on in, Mr. Holmes. Sure thing.
Yeah, and then Watson's like, here, let me borrow a dog. And the guy's like, I'm about to sick 39 bloodhounds to rip your limb from limb.
Yes, yes.
And then he says Sherlock Holmes and just opens the door without further notice.
It's the thing. He doesn't even apologize or like go, oh, this is how I know Holmes. He's just like, oh, all right, I get it. And he just lets him in. It's fantastic.
As I said, it is very much the old-fashioned British sensibilities of literature, and they are nothing if not charming.
Yes.
in their quaintness.
It's the old British humor comedy, you know, shining through. A little bit of black comedy there too, which is always nice to see. Yeah, no, I love Toby. I mentioned last week on the show, the first time I saw Sherlock Holmes was in Basil the Great Mouse Detective. That was my first exposure. And I'm pretty sure Toby's in that too. There is a giant dog that they ride around on as little mice. And I'm pretty sure his name is Toby.
I feel as though dogs in one form or another is a staple of every form of Sherlock Holmes adaptation.
Yeah, yeah.
Though I would not care to list them for the sake of showing my own incompetence with the Sherlock Holmes canon. But that, of course, is why you've challenged me to this book. I will say, Herds, in between this and last week, I was made aware of the fact that I have watched the BBC adaptation titled The Sign of the Three. And I wanted to say, Herds, I've passed you a note under the table here that I won't show the audience in case it comes true. But if it does end up being the case, I will forfeit one of the points.
Okay. Sounds good. I'm into that.
Just because I do not think that they are the same story, but if they share the same elements, I wanted to let you know I'm playing fair here.
You know what? I appreciate that. We're all about fair play in here, not just on the author's side of things, but on our side of things too. Yeah, I did want to point out something real quick because I find it very interesting. Look, because I'm still on the dock. I'm still, you know, fascinated by the introduction of Toby to the narrative. I can't think of any other, you know, detectives that have an animal companion as kind of a mainstay part of the cast, let alone being, you know, the faithful Toby who sniffs out criminals or whatever. Like, you'd think that there would be more murder mysteries where it's like a trusty seed that gets you around, like faster than the police, or, you know, a cat that you pet all the time while you're thinking. Or it seems as though most murder mysteries stick with a purely human cast. And I guess that's because you can't suspects an animal. Like, you can't suddenly say, ah, well, the dog was giving you false information because it's in on the crime, because its master told it to. Like, I guess you could, but I feel like most murder mysteries stray away from that.
All I'm saying, Herds, all I'm going to say is that if we get to the climax of this novel and there is a twist murderer, it is going to be unveiled because Toby smells the chemical on them.
Dude, I'm in. That would be, you know, you get a bonus point if that's what happens. That's straight up it. You get one extra point just for that.
Well, what was the point of me forfeiting a point?
To make up for that point. That's the whole point.
All right. I appreciate your generosity, Herds. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's what I'm here for.
No, I mean, I think that we have seen novels where we've had kind of backup detectives in the form of animal companions. We had Philo Vance's dog in the Kennel Murder case, for example. You know, we said that novel perhaps underutilized its dog companions as well. But, you know, they are out there. They do exist. One could argue the case that Australian television icon Skippy was in fact an animal detective, but...
You know what? That's I don't know if I'm going to make that stretch there.
I don't think that Skippy quite qualifies for this show.
Yeah, I don't think I could go on that journey with you, but I appreciate the thought. Shout out to Skippy.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things in this stretch of the novel is, I mean, obviously we have Sherlock Holmes, as I suspected, completely debunking the locked room within seconds of its appearance, but I did like the way that we were sledgehammered with the use of the British police in this novel. It is obviously a staple of older style mystery novels to have the detective versus the police, and I knew this was going to be the case, but I was somewhat taken aback and somewhat overjoyed by just how incompetent they were.
Oh, it was beautiful. Just like rereading this novel, and the policeman, he comes in and he throws together a half-baked theory. He says, you know, this is probably what happened. And Sherlock Holmes is like, that doesn't make any sense. He says, well, it was close. And he like walks out of the room. He walks out of the room. Like, that's yep. That's all he's there for, to say, this is probably it. I've done my job, you know, I don't need to think about it too hard, and that's it.
If we had established to some extent that, you know, maybe he was trying to get as many collars as he could so that he could buff up his numbers for the month's review, if we'd established that maybe he was being premature for the sake of keeping these people in prison so that they could be protected from whatever actual murderer might be out there, that would be good. But no, he just waltzes in, says, this is what it is, boys, and that's it. You know, obviously Sherlock Holmes has this reputation in London because everyone knows him, but for some reason this police detective is just so willing to basically make himself look like a fool by going against Sherlock, it seems like stupid beyond belief.
It's beautiful. Like the actual line is that Alfie Jones, that's our police officer here, walks in, is trying to, you know, bust open the locked room, sees the like trap door in the ceiling that may have been used to enter the room, and says, aha, see, it's even open. The trap door is even open. So that confirms that's how they got in and out. And Sherlock is like, I did that when I investigated it 10 minutes ago. And he's like, well, that doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter what the facts are. Except that's all I care about is the facts. Like, that's what he says, but it's not what he does. He just completely ignores what Sherlock says and just leaves. And that's it. Like, I don't even think he shows up in the story again. He just is there to be a bumbling detective and amuse us for a few moments. It's kind of refreshing, though. I kind of like it. Like, he's not a proper character, but I have not laughed harder at a detective's, you know, police offense in a very long time.
I mean, as we've said several times in talking about this book, it very much reflects an old-fashioned British comedy, the traces of which perhaps we saw the tail end of and have maybe expired at this point. But the things that I watched growing up definitely kind of reflected similar, if slightly more modern, variations on this same kind of bumbling fool trope. I think especially like ones that I grew up with, like Dad's Army and whatnot, they very much just idolize this idea of the bumbling idiot still managing to do the right thing. And it's curious to see how much of a staple that seems to have been through British history, if that was the case even back at the time of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Very, very satirical comedy, which you can't always tell to somebody who hasn't like experienced these shows before, if it's like is this real? Like, is this really the story that I'm experiencing right now? Like, shout to, you know, Mr. Bean and like Monty Python, all that sort of thing. Like, it's very much that kind of, there's a term for it. Like, it's throwaway. Like, we do not care about your sensibilities. We do not care about like the respect you may have police officers in this moment. We're just here to poke fun at them. It's great.
And it's interesting because I feel like Sherlock Holmes has this mythos of being such a, you know, serious, straight, hardline character. And I don't think that that is necessarily reflected in adaptations, because there are goofy moments definitely in the Robert Downey Jr. adaptation. There's definitely lighthearted moments in the BBC adaptations and, you know, ones that have appeared before that. But I feel like if you were to ask the layman on the street, you know, what is Sherlock Holmes like? I don't think they'd talk about that time that he busted into his house, his own house, dressed as an old man just to fool his housemate, because it's not a moment that feels like it has any weight. It's just a throwaway piece of entertainment, which is great fun, but really just doesn't do anything.
It's one of the tools, the weapons that Sherlock has to deal with criminals, that he has this like network of orphans, and he has these costumes that he uses to fool people and disguises and acting skills and all that sort of thing. But none of that has actually been shown on screen. It's all just been him say, ah, yes, now I will use my orphans. Now I will use my disguise. And he does all of that while Watson sits around and, you know, interrogates another detective for some reason.
And I do think that that is one of the great strengths of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's writing, is that he is so confident at just putting things off screen, much in the same way that Sherlock is confident in making wild guesses about what the truth may be that just happened to be true. You know, when they leave the house in the first few chapters, Watson just says he saw Sherlock pick up his revolver, assuming that it was going to be a serious case. And that's the only mention of like Sherlock's emotions leading in to the actual, you know, case. But it's just a very strong moment of like, this is what is happening, this is why he did it, and we move on. There's no great diatribe between Sherlock and Watson where they're like, oh, how dangerous do you think this will be? It's just, nope, he picks up his revolver and we leave.
I like the word confident there. I think that that's a very good way of describing his writing here. Because he's actually very confident in the portrayal of Watson as well, in the amount of independence he gets. It's not quite the same as Archie Goodwin, where Archie Goodwin's independence and strength is more or less at the expense of Nero Wolfe. But I like that when Sherlock says, hey, Watson, can you go get this dog for me? He just goes and does it. Like, he's strong enough, with a word of Sherlock Holmes' name, he's able to go off and do tasks and investigate things on his own. And I really like that. I like that a lot. It really means that Watson is as compelling and as present and competent a character as Sherlock. Well, maybe not competent. Competent is a stretch, but everything else, like, he's just as much of a character. He's not just the chronicler of Sherlock Holmes's ideas. And on that note, actually, something I neglected to mention in the first part is that Watson and Sherlock, they discuss Watson's detailing of A Study in Scarlet, and Holmes actually berates him for the way that he portrays the story as being very romantic, which is funny because that's a criticism that people kind of had at the second half of the novel. Like, well, this isn't the mystery at all. This is just some you know, cowboys in Utah. Why does this matter to the murder mystery? And so he's being very self-aware there, Mr. Arthur Conan Doyle is. And I don't know, I love it. I love it so much.
You know, obviously we are a big fan here on the show of very responsive authors to the musings of their audience and what they've done in their past works. And it's phenomenal to see a pioneer in the genre such as Arthur Conan Doyle actually being so incredibly self-aware when really he had no one to answer to because his only competition was himself.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is still very early in his career, and you can already see him improving, which is, it's very admirable. Those are always my favorite authors in any genre, not just murder mystery, but authors and comic writers and game developers and, you know, all sorts of media creators. Anybody who I can kind of watch go from writing something that is competent and kind of honest and genuine, slowly, you know, understanding what their audience wants and what they're capable of, and growing and growing and growing and building this kind of great mythos behind their characters, in this case, Sherlock Holmes, I really appreciate getting to read that journey.
Well, Herds, I think we should take a pause, come back in a short bit, and we will speak about this mystery and how I think it can be solved.
Sounds good. You're going to have to solve it. I'm sure you have a very difficult time with this. This is
extraordinarily difficult.
This is a Sherlock Holmes novel. This is so difficult, guys.
Yes, renowned for it.
Renowned.
Anyway, we are Flex and Herds. We are discussing The Sign of the Four, chapters 6 to 9 by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. We will be back with more of that in just a minute. You're listening to 2SER. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds here, discussing The Sign of the Four by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle on your Murder Mystery World Tour. It is our second week on Death of the Reader with this book. We are discussing chapters 6 to 9. I am challenged, tasked, in fact, with solving this incredibly complex, detailed, intricate, confusing, bewildering mystery. And this is all Herds' scripting on the page in front of me because I fundamentally disagree with all of those.
What do you mean? It's such a hard murder mystery. You could never guess the culprit. It could be anyone. There are so many options to pick from, like Jonathan Small, and maybe Thaddeus, and
maybe three other people from India who have at no point in the story appeared, or the random noble savage who doesn't seem to have anything to do with anything.
Ah, yes, the noble savage. We have not talked about the noble savage. I don't... Let's put it this way. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle might be suffering from a little bit of old-itis. Let's call it that. The way that he describes the ethnic individual in this story.
I believe Adanian.
He could have just left it at there was an Adanian character, but instead they're described as like narrow, fierce eyes and like an ugly face and like squat and like it's, look, it's bad. It's not good. If you are easily offended by racism in general, bad depictions of ethnic individuals, do not read this novel.
I will correct myself. It is Andamans. He is an Andaman Aborigine. I mean, listen, it was a different time, a different place. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was clearly, as you say, suffering from a case of the colonialisms.
He describes him as naturally hideous. That's how he says there's a black character in the story. They are naturally hideous. That is the only real defining quality other than being small.
And then perhaps three paragraphs later says that no women are to be trusted to a full extent and ever. I think that these are things you should be aware of if you are going in to read old novels. It is just the way things are going to be because old people in the 1800s were a little bit racist, a little bit sexist.
A little bit racist, a little bit offensive, would not be writing these novels in the modern day. Maybe in the third part it'll turn around. It'll turn out that this is always a big setup. This, like, I don't know, Islander character, they've been set up and they're really just a nice, swell guy. But I doubt it somehow. I doubt it.
Yeah, anyhow, let's get into this case because I think... it is simultaneously staggering to me how little has changed in this story, but also how much has happened, because Jonathan Small, the peg-legged man, has made an escape, waltzed off through the city to a man called Mordecai Smith, taken a steamboat, and more or less just disappeared. And I'm a little confused as to where this is going, because we spend a long time chasing him through the city. We have a fun little bit with Toby where he follows the wrong scent of a chemical, and...
Will that matter? Who knows?
I guess it's kind of just meant to be a tension-building moment.
Well, this is the thing, right, that I find so interesting about this novel, because if the culprit is Jonathan Small, which I assume is where you're going with this, then Sherlock Holmes picked him as the culprit literally one chapter after the crime was introduced.
And before he had ever appeared on screen.
Yes, and he still hasn't. Also, Jonathan Small and, like, it seems to have been very quickly accepted that Jonathan Small is our quarry based on the amount of effort that Holmes is going to try and pin him down. So that's why, like, even last week, I was saying, like, either this is all building towards a very straightforward conclusion, or there's got to be, like, a subversion of this entire journey. Like, I do not believe there is a middle ground there where it'll suddenly become, like, a sensible mystery.
I think that the subversion that is going to happen is that it is going to turn out that that Jonathan Small is the honorable one, and that it is Major Sholter and Captain Morstan who have, in fact, wronged him, just so that we actually get some plausible motive for the man,
okay,
rather than him just being quite literally a murderous pirate rampaging the streets of London.
That'd be pretty cool, though. I'd like to be a murderous pirate rampaging the streets of London. That sounds like fun. Stealing steamboats and walking around with a pig leg and, like, threatening housewives or whatever. Like, look, I'm in.
I will say, I am a little confused as to the steamboat thing. That I think that is probably the singular most confusing point about the story. One could easily point to it as being, oh, he has taken a boat so that they will lose his scent trail, but I don't know why 8 hours after the crime supposedly took place, he's particularly worried about people being hot on his trails. It's a little bit up the creek. I think the only plausible thing is that maybe he is going to, like, drop the jewels at, like, the bottom of the Thames River until things blow over and then come get them back again. But I don't understand why we've chosen the steamboat, and if Mordecai Smith actually has anything significant to do other than just being a hired gun.
Well, that is the question, isn't it? We don't know much about this Mordecai Smith, do we? We know that they have a wife who's looking for him, and Sherlock Holmes has put an ad in the paper saying, golly gee, I'd love to find that Mordecai Smith.
It was a bit strange, that ad in the paper, because yeah. Watson comes in and he goes, oh, that clever Sherlock. It's like, what was clever about that? He just put his own address at the bottom of a missing person's notice.
It's even better that, you know, Watson comes up with these ideas. He says, what do we ask amongst the boatsmen and see if they know? And he's like, no, that's too suspicious. The boatsmen will then know that we're looking for him. And he says, what about the police? Says, no, they'll tip him off even more. And he's like, ah, oh, put a note in the paper. Like, Mordecai Smith probably can't read. That's fine. Like whatever.
It doesn't make any sense.
That's the only explanation I can come up with, is that they think that he can't read. So that like, he'll be able to detect people talking about him, trying to find his boat, but not in the paper. He just won't be able to read about it, so it won't be a problem.
It's definitely peculiar. It doesn't make much sense. But the thing I'm left puzzled about, Herds, is if this story is actually going to bring around many of the concepts that it's introduced, because last week you were talking about, you know, the chemicals being introduced and the laboratory that was going on. You know, we were speaking about how there was the locked room and that got immediately blown open. And if this was a serialized story, which it may have been, I'm not entirely certain about that.
I don't think it was. It's a short story, but I don't think it was serialized, no.
But if it was originally written with the intent of being serialized, I could maybe follow that these things were just being left behind because they were the previous week's edition and he'd maybe made some changes in response to people's writing. But because it is one whole novel and things just seem to keep disappearing off in the distance, I don't really understand what Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is trying to do with the puzzle, if anything, at this point. Because it seems to almost be forgetful of its own mentions. The fact that they're twins, I think, came up exactly once so far in the story, and whilst in other books I'd say, ah, yes, a subtle clue that perhaps will point to later twists, we haven't seen any further evidence to the fact that the Sholto twins are doing anything, you know, subversive to Sherlock. They seem to very much just be out of the picture entirely at the moment.
They haven't been on screen, certainly, but perhaps that's where the murderer hides, in the shadows, in the periphery. But yeah, we get this policeman come back, and he's like, hey, you slipped through my net because I couldn't find a way to pierce through his alibi. And it's like, surely there is a puzzle there that we could be playing with rather than just dismissing it completely.
Yep, but we never get to hear what the alibi is, who has provided it. You know, if it could be said that it was all of the housekeepers who were maintaining that alibi, then it would be quite easy to create a circular alibi where they all had each other covered while they were all working on the crime together. But because we never get to hear the alibis, we have nothing to go off and nothing to work with, and thus it seems it is no part of the mystery at all.
This is one of the challenges that I face when trying to figure out where in this novel I should cut off each part, because we really get all of the clues at once that are relevant to the mystery, and then we just kind of chase Jonathan Small for a while. So really, like I could have, you know, cut the first part at chapter 4, I guess, and had the murder in the second part. But even then, like, I don't think there's enough clues in that case. It was a bit of a challenge to try and split this up. But anyway, we'll see if you are actually correct. You're still suspecting Jonathan Small, correct?
I'm still suspecting Jonathan Small. I suspect that the captain and the major back in the Indian conflict have somehow wronged Mr. Small.
Sure.
I don't know exactly how. It is implied that he was a convict, correct?
I believe so.
I think that the most likely thing is perhaps that the major and the captain were responsible for this convict camp and used their station to take advantage of the prisoners. Looking back further, the actual first mention of being a convict guard was in chapter 2, and that had skipped my mind until they mentioned it later on. So I think that perhaps is one of the few examples of things coming back around in the story, and that points to me as it thus being significant. Perhaps the reason he was so afraid of the peg-legged man is because he realized that he'd screwed him over and was now coming for Major Sholto's spoils, basically.
I suppose we'll have to wait and see how accurate all of that is. But yes, there is mention that the treasure apparently that has been gathered. There's the chart to do with the treasure is dated back to a time when Morstan was actually brought into close association with convicts. So it seems like Jonathan Small might have been a part of that situation there. What do you think? I'm not going to judge any points based on this, but apparently this Andonian or whatever, this very terrible racial archetype, what do you think that they fit into the picture, if at all?
I am a little confused. I remember that it was the Andaman Islands that the major and the captain were convict guards there, but I would hesitate to say whether they are one of the Sign of the Four. I think it is implied through the way that he is described as the terrible, stereotypical noble savage that he is perhaps unrelated to the, you know, the convict situation itself. It was more likely that perhaps he was someone who helped Jonathan Small escape from the prison early, and that's why the major was surprised or something along those lines.
Yeah, friends in low places, as it were.
I will say, though, the one thing that I am hoping becomes explained and I do feel dumb about is the 3.37 from left thing that was in the letter. I feel like that was too specific a detail for it to be left alone, but I have seen nothing to point at it thus far, be it like, you know, this is where the keys are going to be stashed from a certain position, or this is, you know, what time we're staging our escape. I don't know, but I hope that that comes back around again.
Yeah, I can't really comment on that particular number. It's surely a very significant number that will become, you know, we'll have a revelation. We'll realize, 3.37, it's your birthday combined with the number of dogs that I've owned in the past divided by 12. Which is something significant. But yeah, I'm not too worried about you solving that particular mystery. I don't know how fair play that particular one is.
I do not suspect it to be fair play. I just hope that it is at least solvable.
Maybe. I will say, this is after all a story that introduces Watson's wife, well, you know, soon-to-be wife, Miss Mary. Do you think that she'll have any part in the resolution going forward?
I hope so, but I would hesitate to guess at what. My perspective on her character, I will say, is somewhat tarnished by her representation in various adaptations, where I get the impression that her significance to the story has been vastly overstated relative to the book.
One of the things that Watson seems to be worried about is that if Mary gets this treasure, she becomes a rich, noble lady, that he won't be able to pursue her anymore.
It could be a closing tension to the book, but I do not think that it is likely to be the entire crux of the ending. I feel like in the spirit of old-fashioned detective fiction, we're more likely to sit down with Jonathan Small and impress upon the world what was going on the entire way through this.
I suppose we'll have to find out next time, unless you have any other mysteries you want to bust wide open.
No, I think that's just about all I had to bust open.
I think it is, honestly. But it's been a pleasure. And yeah, if you have managed to solve this, go along with this, you pretty much unchanged the answer from Sherlock Holmes's, it seems, which is interesting. But if you do happen to get this right, you'll have 2 points on the table, because your answer has been pretty similar to the one for the first part. So,
provided, of course, that the note I've slipped you under the table does not tie into the solution.
We'll talk about that when we get there, mister. Don't you get your panties in a bunch.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds here on your Murder Mystery World Tour. We will be going from chapter 10 to the end, the 12th chapter of The Sign of the Four, next week on Death of the Reader by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Look forward to joining you then. You're listening to 2SER.